Hi, I'm nervous, of course. Hello, everyone. My name is Evelyn, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I am absolutely honored and amazed to be chosen to speak here. I want to thank my friend from California for inviting me onto the panel. And I did accept. It was far enough ahead of time that I said sure, but now that we're here at the moment, the nerves are kicking in. My last drink, just to give you some of my story, was January 6th of 1989. That was after New Year's, and I was absolutely hitting bottom at that time. My life, as I knew it, was over. So I started into my recovery. Back in 1981, I had achieved sobriety, but relapsed consistently over 8 years. It seemed to be a pattern of mine every 6 months or so to relapse. As soon as I would get that chip, I had a deal with a friend of mine to break it in half, and each of us would keep a piece of it, but I would relapse every time. I had to turn to my higher power, and that's where I got my strength. So I spent years searching for that strength and looking within myself. And I reached a point where I finally obtained humility and accepted the fact that I am an alcoholic. And that was my last drink in 89. I was born to a family of alcoholics, so of course I had the childhood experience of seeing not only my parents, but other relatives on down the line, family of drinkers and heavy smokers. I'm the oldest of several sisters and had to keep them in line because we weren't very well taken care of. We oftentimes went without food, and I had to take it upon myself, even though I was deaf, to knock on neighbors' doors and ask for eggs and different handouts, which was incredibly embarrassing for my mother, who wanted me to stop doing that. But I said, "Mom, we have no food in the house. What are we supposed to do?" You know. And I grew up at a residential school for the deaf where the food was great. It was a wonderful experience. Felt very safe there, and all the other kids hated the dorm life and the school and the cafeteria, but I loved it because it was food. It was all I knew of food. But anyway, that's part of my childhood that that was a great impact on me. Until about the age of 13 or 14, I remember my father gave me a drink. And I fell in love with the drink. Vodka, anything. You know, we would hide, and my sister and I would go out and hide and drink and do it in secret, come up with different concoctions and mix it down so no one would notice that it was actually alcohol. And we continued doing that all through our teens until I was about 16 and noticed how dysfunctional my family had become. And so I would take the subway and go to different events in the community with deaf friends for those who were 18 and up. We didn't have any events for people my age, but even being young, I went ahead and disguised my age and learned to lie. You know, you had to be 21 to drink, but I made sure that I dressed up and put on enough makeup so that it wouldn't be a dead giveaway. And so they would take me into the clubs and give me drinks. So I learned to lie. And I didn't realize that this was the behavior of an alcoholic until many years later when I married. By the age of 18, 19, I was drinking heavily. I got pregnant. I didn't know how to control my life. I would be at a party with a pregnant belly and a drink sitting on my stomach. It was just horrible. And at the same time, luckily enough, I ate healthy enough that I had a healthy child born. And I was trying to get my health back on track. And I drank all through all four of my pregnancies. My final pregnancy with my daughter was when I really hit bottom. I was into drugs and pills and mixed them with drinking. That's when I absolutely reached the worst point in my life. I went to sleep in the bathtub, fully clothed. I would go out into the community. I developed a beer belly. I dressed poorly. My clothes were so bad that I would just take them off and throw them out the window. I was an embarrassment to the community. I was caught drunk driving several times. I had blacked out. I don't even remember where I was at that time. I knew that I was out bowling with friends, but I don't know where I ended up at 1 or 2 in the morning. I can remember that moment of waking up and looking out the window and thinking, oh, my car is still there. You know, everything's okay. Nothing terrible had happened to me. No, I didn't get in a wreck. Everything is okay. Just incredibly risky behavior with these blackouts. And then it ended up that I became homeless. My husband was abusive. He couldn't tolerate my behavior. I thought everything was my fault. I thought the abuse was my fault. It was just a terrible time in my life. He hurt me greatly, which caused me to turn even more heavily to pills and drinking. I was homeless for about 6 months, and I was in and out of the home. And then I would go into a shelter and then back out on the street and bringing my family with me. My family didn't identify me as being an alcoholic. And I ended up in and out of stability and then homelessness and in the shelter. And one day I ran into a random person who was not deaf, who was an alcoholic. And it was on a playground, a kid's playground. And I was sitting there with a drink stuffed down inside my jacket, having a sip, you know, in front of the kids. I didn't care. I didn't know that they should care. But I had this person approach me, a total stranger, who was able to sign. This person approached me saying, I'm learning sign language. They signed to me. This was in the 80s, which, of course, signing is more popular now, but we're talking about 1980s, where it was incredibly rare to run into anyone who signed. But this woman, who was an alcoholic and could sign, came up to me and said, I think you might have a drinking problem. I'm an alcoholic. And as soon as she signed AA, I thought, you know what, that's not for me. That's for those bums out there who really, really have nothing. And she said, no, let me tell you about how this goes. You know, there are professionals, there are lawyers and doctors and people who are well off who are alcoholics. It affects everyone. And I started listening to what she had to say. And we were across from where I lived at the time and went over, invited her in, and it ended up into a several hour long conversation to talk about, you know, the abuse, the alcohol, the 12 steps, which of course I was not familiar with. We don't have treatment for the deaf specifically in Massachusetts at that time. And so she said that that was one of her goals. And sure enough, she did establish a center for deaf women who were struggling with addiction. And I didn't really necessarily identify that I needed that right away, but I did start showing up, and I got introduced to a counselor who was incredibly helpful to me, who introduced me to the other women there, and I was there for 5 years of treatment, and it was an absolute journey for me to identify my wrongs and my embarrassment and my past and to have those validated and talk through the steps. So I worked through step one, step two, step three. I worked through step one and three and four until the counselor said, well, let's back up here. We need to know more about your family. So she really encouraged me to focus more on digging into how these things affected my life. I was very resistant to step three. My kids were a big part of my journey, identifying how I had hurt my kids and letting them come to me and give me that awakening and that reality of how I had hurt them. That was a big part of my journey. because I didn't have an education. I was living in the world with an eighth grade education. I never finished high school. I started drinking, and I got married young and continued drinking. And I had to come full circle and realize that I needed to clear up some things for myself. I had no ability to apply for a job. I didn't have an education. I wanted to go for a GED, and they offered that program. So I started out in the GED program, and that's where I really started my love of learning. And I made it through and passed and got my GED, which I thought would never happen. And then I decided that I wanted more school, more education, and that led me to a mentor who ended up teaching me some English, and in exchange, I taught that mentor American Sign Language. And that was an adult education experience. So it was a great opportunity for us to help one another. And that led me to think about attending college, which of course was very nerve-wracking. I didn't know if I could do it. And of course you have to take a test if you want to be admitted to college. And I was incredibly nervous about it, but I went and passed the test. Ended up getting accepted to a graduate prep program and then into graduate school, on to obtaining a master's degree in education. And I thought, I didn't necessarily want to use that degree in the school system. I wanted that to be of service to other alcoholics. So I got that master's in education without any knowledge or experience having that educational background in my young days, and I truly believe that it's the higher power that led me to put in those applications and to make it that far. You know, without that higher power, I would have been absolutely messed up in my life over and over and over. And I truly believe that these things happen for me because of what my higher power led me to do. So I was able to graduate with a degree. I was able to think about a job. And I humbly applied for jobs and got hired and got promoted. Started working for a team on the hospital for 3 years within the mental health field. And then I had to step down because of some health reasons. I was ill for a few years. And I thought, you know, I thought I would never hold down a job, but the higher power believed differently. You know, I had this nagging that was in my life that I just needed to do it, to try it. The profession that I worked in, I was untrained for. I had no direct experience for it. So I have no reason other than the higher power that I was able to join that field and do well. So without that relationship with the higher power, I certainly would not have gotten this far. I can remember a time when my higher power was telling me to stop drinking, to stop your craving for drinking. That spiritual awakening, that higher power, that's truly how I remained sober. Back in 1989, I remember that very clearly, and that led me to today. I thought that I could control my drinking, that I could decide for myself, but that was just a fallacy. It came from my higher power, and day by day I added strength and belief in myself. And to today, I'm here in an international conference speaking to you all. So I just want to thank you for letting me share a little bit about my journey. Thank you so much.
Your experienced strength and hope with us. I've been asked to share a little bit in between the talks. I just want to mention one thing. Now I'm a GSO staff member and I'm on the assignment for treatment, special needs, and accessibilities. I started at the General Service Office in March of 2013. So I came in right at the release time of the pamphlet A for the Alcoholic with Special Needs that's available on DVD with ASL interpretation, subtitles, and audio are all included in that format. My predecessor had, you know, worked on the assignment through the production of it. And during the course of my 2 years with communication from the deaf and hard of hearing community within the fellowship and then the publishing department at AWS is in the process of retranslating the big book in the 12 and 12 in ASL to provide it as an update. I think the last time when it was published, it was about 20 years ago. So those will be available sometime in the forthcoming months, also with audio and subtitled format included on the DVD. So that's a little bit from my desk and some tidbit of sharing in between our panelists. Our next panelist is going to be sharing with you. Her name is Norma. And if you would join us at the podium.
Hello, everybody. My name's Norma, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 1st, 1983, and my home group is a single-purpose group in Austin, Texas. It's always a privilege and a pleasure to share my experience, strength, and hope with any group of recovered alcoholics, but it's certainly a thrill to be here at the International Convention where we're getting to enjoy the incredible feeling of what it's like to be part of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as the chairman of the General Service Board, Terry Bedient, so eloquently expressed in this last month's Grapevine, he said, "It's with deep gratitude we celebrate 80 years of carrying the message of hope throughout the world. Happy, joyous, and free, we celebrate Alcoholics Anonymous." Well said. Yeah. So, now I'd like to share with you my journey on how I became involved with treatment and special needs or accessibilities, and more specifically with our Deaf AA members. I remember going to my first area assembly as a new GSR for my home group. A whole new world came into view as I met dedicated people who were very experienced with living the traditions, upholding the concepts, and truly serving AA with wisdom, humility, and dignity. It was love in action, and I became inspired to learn more, do more, and be more. After my term as GSR was up, I was voted in as District Treatment Facilities Chair, the last thing I wanted to do, because I thought I knew everything about AA service through treatment. After all, I'd been going to treatment centers, carrying the message for many years. But as I began reading the treatment facility workbook, studying the related literature, and learning about this type of AA service, I found out a lot that I had missed. I wasn't carrying the AA message, I was carrying Norma's message. It wasn't about helping others, it was more about impressing others. And I wasn't cooperating with the professionals, I was criticizing their methods. I was bossy, arrogant, and egotistical, and I didn't even know it. The literature helped me understand how to apply the spiritual principles of our program through the traditions, how to carry the message more effectively. With this new understanding, I began to bring in AA pamphlets to the treatment facility meetings for newcomers, sharing about the Bridge the Gap programs, Bridge the Gap. Intergroup information and meeting list came with me, and I found that AA had produced some interesting DVDs for young people, for people transitioning out of jail, and other things, and these were a big hit. Big hit, by the way. I didn't bring popcorn. I should have. But I also brought in AA members I knew of all ages and genders and ethnic backgrounds to share their experience, strength, and hope. It became less about me and what I had to offer and more about AA and what we had to offer. As district treatment chair, I had the opportunity to share all of this with other interested AA members and to coordinate our efforts. I gave workshops on things I read about that seemed to be most important, things like anonymity, cooperation without affiliating, singleness of purpose, and how this all applied within treatment settings. It was an incredible experience that I will never forget. And all of this occurred about 5 years ago at the time of our last international convention in San Antonio. By now, I had been demoted to area treatment chair. And one of the workshops I planned to do for the fellowship was on special needs alcoholics. I'd been reading the literature about the members of our fellowship that qualified as AA members who needed a little extra help in gaining access to the message of hope. And what I found was that the home group could easily meet the needs of most of these alcoholics by providing space for wheelchairs or physically disabled alcoholics, rides to blind alcoholics, or materials in braille and audio format, spending extra time and attention for those that may be learning disabled or dyslexic, and taking meetings into those that were homebound. Our home groups have always had love and compassion for newcomers, no matter what obstacles stand in the way of their recovery. However, the exception was the deaf alcoholic, because of the difference in language. Without an interpreter, the deaf AA member could not participate in most AA meetings. This brought up another issue, a financial one. Who would pay for the interpreter? How many times a week would an interpreter be needed? Could an AA group afford that? Well, shouldn't the deaf person or social service agencies be responsible? All these questions came up as I began to look at the special needs of our deaf AA members. It was at this time that a deaf woman came into my life, and our paths in recovery and service became intertwined from that moment on. She had moved here from Cleveland, Ohio. After quitting her job, finding a new home, moving thousands of miles from one place to another, she came to Austin, Texas, on the promise that a certain government agency was to provide interpretation for the AA meeting she needed to attend. 2 days before she arrived, she finds the funds for this agency had been cut and no longer available. At an area assembly, the former treatment chairperson found me and introduced us and said, "Here's an AA member who needs our help." So my new friend and I, some of you know her, Deb, we put our heads together to try to solve the problem of accessibility to the message of AA. We looked at what AA had done in other parts of the United States, and we found that in Portland, Oregon, they had come up with a working solution. They formed an accessibility committee, petitioned the AA groups in their district to reserve some of their Seventh Tradition donations for the Deaf Access Committee. And with the help of many AA groups, the money they received was pooled, put together to provide interpreters for the deaf AA members. And that way, the financial responsibility did not fall on any deaf AA member, which, especially for a newcomer, might be difficult, if not impossible. And the responsibility was not given to any one AA group, which could deplete the funds of a home group quickly and leave little to nothing for their ongoing expenses or contributions to the whole of AA. The Portland example seemed like a good solution. So after conferring with a few past DCMs and intergroup officers, we decided to form a committee and come up with a similar plan. The Austin Deaf Access Committee was born in 2010. We are now 4.5 years old, and with the tremendous support of the AA groups in Austin and the surrounding areas and the local districts, and the continued support of the Hill Country Intergroup Association, and Clint R., the past intergroup manager, was our most loyal and vocal supporter, we started with one AA meeting a week and one monthly business meeting. Today we have 4 to 5 meetings a week supported by AA, plus 2 more that we include on our calendar that are interpreted through social service agencies that we cooperate with, totaling 5 to 6 weekly AA meetings over town. Yeah. Our big book says on page 162 that someday we hope that every alcoholic who journeys will find a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous at his destination. And I can say that because of DAC in Austin, Texas, this has become true for all AA members. I've just shared with you how it works. Now let me share with you what happened and what it's like now. As we visited many group consciences of various AA groups in our district, it was just as important to share not only who we are and why we exist, but also what we are not. We are not a social service agency, and we are not providing social services because AA is not an organization. AA is a spiritual fellowship, and we have but one purpose, to carry the message. We are not providing material needs, but spiritual needs. We exist to make it possible for deaf AA members to have access to our message of hope. We're not advocating for deaf rights because AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, organization, politics, or institution. We're not endorsing a political agenda. We have but one cause to live for, carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. We make no demands of any AA group. We simply inform them of the need and how it is connected to our primary purpose. We ask them to consider sending a portion of their Seventh Tradition funds to help our deaf AA members receive the experience, strength, and hope AA offers, and talk about why this plan is effective. It's like this. If I buy a big book for a newcomer, I've helped one alcoholic find out how to get sober. If I send money to GSO, I've helped a lot of alcoholics find out how to get sober. If your group pays for an interpreter, you may help only one deaf person if they live close to you. But if you send contributions to the Deaf Access Committee, you've helped all deaf AA members in our city to find the solution. We never asked the AA groups to send in a particular amount, though when we answered questions, we discussed the amount it would take to pay interpreters. We suggested they divide what they were sending to intergroup in half, earmarking a portion for the DAC, which is what most groups decided to do, as by now we had become a permanent standing committee of intergroup. Milton Maxwell, past chairman of the General Service Board, said, AA unity is not based upon authority, but upon accepting differences, allowing freedom, and keeping our focus on the primary purpose of helping one another achieve and maintain sobriety. May it ever be so. One of the things that made a huge difference in the maintaining our committee and its purpose was continual communication, attending group consciences, district meetings, intergroup representative meetings, staying transparent financially, and money coming in being used only for one purpose, interpreting AA meetings. We did not use funds to interpret local AA events or conferences. We felt it more important to make sure our deaf AA members had access to regular meetings in a home group of their choice. This is another important reason for our success. In the past, an AA group decided on their own to have their meeting interpreted. But no deaf person was consulted, no deaf AA member made the request, and consequently, no deaf person showed up. This happens everywhere. People with good intentions doing something for someone who knows nothing about it. And now a group has lost valuable Seventh Tradition funds, and there are possibly some bad feelings. So through our Deaf Access Committee, we have accomplished several things. We enable deaf people to choose what meeting they want to go to through an online request form. And we have the coordination, payment, and qualifications of interpreters left to those who have experience with these things, which takes the financial and organizational burden off the groups and off intergroup. Event organizers frequently said they wanted their AA event to be interpreted so as to include everyone, so we had to make some hard decisions. We decided to find a way to cooperate, share important information, and ended up developing a policy on how to cooperate with other local AA people organizing events. It took some education and information sharing on what worked well. We had to communicate that when you're planning an AA event or conference, it helps to be financially prepared ahead of time. We shared guidelines already created by the fellowship on carrying the message to the deaf alcoholic and guidelines on conferences, conventions, and roundups. And we also suggested people read information we provided on our website, which shared more compiled experience. Another thing vital to our success and continuation was to understand how important it is not just to have deaf AA members participate on the committee, but that there be equal representation of hearing and deaf AA members every time, everywhere the Deaf Access Committee shared. Why? Because I, as a member of AA, can share about being an alcoholic. I may have had some struggles in sobriety as a woman, a mother, a single parent, a professional. But I could not, and I can share the fears and successes around these things as they relate to my sobriety. But I have no experience with being deaf. And so, for a hearing alcoholic to try and represent the fellowship and the struggles and the needs of a deaf alcoholic is kind of like a man trying to understand what it's like to be a woman. My husband's still working on that after 26 years of marriage. I can tell AA everything I know about why it's important to meet the needs of our deaf AA friends and how it relates to our common welfare, our single purpose, tradition 3 and 8, our responsibility statement, and more. But the moment a deaf AA member stands up and shares their personal experience as an alcoholic and the deep and sincere desire to be part of AA in the same way others are, everything changes. Only a deaf person can represent the experience, needs, and values within their culture and as an alcoholic. As our big book says, experience is a thing of supreme value in life. It is the sharing of the deaf AA member that allows the language of the heart to be experienced. One alcoholic talking to another. This was the most effective message the Deaf Access Committee had to offer. What is it like today? Today, no one in Austin, Texas is surprised to see a deaf person at an AA meeting. Deaf AA members have home groups, they chair meetings, they have service responsibilities. Our AA groups benefit from those deaf AA members who share how they are growing in effectiveness and understanding. Many AA events in and around Austin are interpreted. And deaf AA members are asked to speak at our groups, and we provide interpreters. Our newest meeting in Austin does not require an interpreter. It is a linguistic meeting in which all the members share in American Sign Language. I missed it last night, as did several others, because we're all here. But I can tell you that our first ASL-only AA meeting, the enthusiasm was high. Here was a place where no one speaks for you. The integrity of deaf culture is respected. The new alcoholic is not viewed as different or disabled, but welcomed in their own language. It is a closed meeting to protect anonymity, and we are growing in numbers and spiritual power. There's much more I could share with everyone that's important, such as how our committee gains strength through the use and knowledge of our traditions, our personal growth through focusing on spiritual principles instead of alcoholic personalities, The process of writing guidelines and bylaws and policies as new situations arose, setting standards for service positions, continual outreach both within AA and to the professional communities that may cross paths with deaf people who may benefit from AA. The challenge of rotation for a service arena that not everyone is attracted to. Our PICPC work with interpreters who have a little trouble with certain AA lingo, like hitting bottom, rocketed into the fourth dimension, shivering denizens of his mad realm, and my favorite, the whoopee party. Now I have to apologize to the interpreters. Transcending the language barriers of the 1930s terminology of the Big Book, the English language of the dominant culture, recovery lingo, that's a lot to deal with. We're helping our cherished interpreters to understand the basic message of AA so our deaf AA members do not miss out on what's being shared. I recently heard from our delegate that there is a committee consideration to changing all references of special needs to accessibilities instead, including the trustees' conference and committee names. This change will show how AA overall can focus on carrying the message instead of limiting the view of the alcoholic through describing their differences. If the truth be known, and there were 50 deaf people in a room sharing their experience, strength, and hope in sign language, and someone walked in who doesn't know sign language, who would the limited person be? Yeah. Michael pointed this out last night. As someone once said, the handicap of deafness is not in the ear, it is in the mind. I, for one, would be in favor of allowing more respect and dignity toward each other by focusing on our assets and recognizing that being different is not always a disability. The Deaf Access Committee in Austin, Texas, has worked hard to provide various guidelines and our combined experience for those who wish to create their own accessibility committee. We are happy to share these with you, and you can reach us through the Hill Country Intergroup Association. We are at www.austinaa.org. Whether accessibility is achieved through an intergroup committee, a district committee, or an area accessibility committee, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that it begins. Begin with a conversation and with willingness, open-mindedness, and honesty, what has happened with us can happen with you. I personally would suggest, too, that you pray and ask the God of your understanding to help you every step of the way. I will close with this thought. Bill W. wrote in 1960 of our 12th step, "We now entrust you of AA's distant reaches, you who so well symbolize the unique and loving communication that is ours in this universal fellowship, to carry the message to fellow members everywhere, and most especially to all those others who still know it not, and who, God willing, may soon issue out of their darkness into light." Thank you all, and God bless.
Okay, thank you very much, Norma. Thank you for that sharing. Thought to mention that the General Service Office staff positions rotate every 2 years or so. So coming around by the end of October, there will be another staff member in the treatment special needs accessibilities assignment. So it's a resource. And one of the main things that we do at the office is connect local sharing with local sharing. So some of those, one of the most common questions I've gotten over the 2 years related to AA and the deaf community has been the covering the expenses of interpretation, and along with the sharing that we just heard from Norma, you know, the way that problem gets addressed is different from place to place. I know in southern Wisconsin they have a line item budget in their area now, so that anyone anywhere for whatever reason is requesting ASL interpreting, the area pays for it. In St. Louis, an individual member started requesting support for meetings to be interpreted with a district. Another district heard of it, and then now there's a number of districts that are combining money to afford more and more ASL interpreted meetings. And the last I spoke with the trusted servant there, they were looking at how they were going to figure out how to make it a standing budget item somewhere within their service structure. So I think through the, you know, through being guided by love and service, we can solve whatever problems come to us to make this, you know, this message we have of recovery through AA available to one another. And hope we can keep doing that and keep getting, you know, we'll get some more experience, strength, and hope here from our next panelist, Linda. So please welcome Linda.
Everyone, my name is Linda, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 1st of 2005. my friends over there. First, I want to thank AA for this honor and privilege to speak and to share my experience, strength, and hope with Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first got the email from Eva Sanchez, I thought she had sent it to me by accident, and then it went on to say for the deaf and hearing impaired, which I am, and so I thought, well, she might have the right person, and she did so, but I'm very, very, very blessed, and I want to thank my friends who have taken time out of their busy schedules to come here today, and I'm very grateful for that. And the rest of you for being here. And you know that the flag ceremony last night was just the most amazing thing. All the countries where AA is now and all the languages the Big Book has been translated into is really wonderful. And you know, I've heard before that blindness keeps separates you from things, and deafness separates you from people. And not that I want to be deaf, but I do believe that that's true. And I was born very healthy, and I then set out on a mission of self-destruction, for which I've had to ask my higher power for forgiveness. But you know, going back a little bit, or a lot really, I had three fathers before the age of six. My third father adopted me. My second father died 14 days after my mother married him from a brain aneurysm, and my first father abandoned me. And I came to learn many years later, many, in fact, not too long ago, that my biological grandmother died at the age of 34 from a lit cigarette passed out in bed. So her death certificate did not say alcoholism, but that is a direct result of what she died. And my first drink was at the age of 13. I'd never seen either of my parents drink. I didn't know what how much of this stuff you had to drink to get that feeling, but I was starting to hang around with kids who were talking about partying and how much fun they were having, and I was asking questions, you know, well, how does it make you feel? And they were telling me, and I knew before I even picked up a drink that that was my solution. I was addicted to alcohol before I even put it in my body. And so at the age of 13, I stole money from my mother, and I asked to sleep over at my friend's house, whose mother was very lenient. And so I was already lying and manipulating for alcohol, something that went on for many years. And got some orange vodka, a pint of it. And like I said, I didn't know how much of this I needed to drink, so I drank all of it. And I can still remember, like it was yesterday, that warm burning feeling going down my throat, that warm feeling in my belly, and then my fears and inhibitions went away, and I was just on fire until I passed out. But I loved it. I loved alcohol, and you know, I moved out. Well, I had two suicide attempts. When I was 16, I came home drunk, got grounded forever, and went up and cleaned out the medicine closet chest. And I remember writhing on the floor of my parents' bedroom in pain, and they called the hospital, and the hospital asked them what I'd taken, and they said, well, she's probably not going to die, and it's too late to pump her stomach. She'll be okay. So life went on. At the age of 17, the same thing happened. Came home drunk. And my parents waited up for me, and they grounded me because I was wasted. And I went up and cleaned out the medicine cabinet. But this time in the middle of the night, I had aspirated, which means that I had vomited, and the mixture of alcohol and outside issues, instead of coming out my throat, they actually went in my windpipe and in my lungs. So I was supposed to get up to be at work at 7 o'clock in this little restaurant that my friend's father owned, and I was supposed to be there at 7. And my mother woke up at 7:30, and she realized I was still in bed. Like, no parent should see their child like this. My face was purple and my lips were blue, and I wasn't breathing. I was so determined to not cry up here. And so they took, the ambulance came and got me, and I had... They got me in time, and they put little pipes in my windpipe to keep it open because it had collapsed. They had collapsed, and I was in intensive care for several days, and I couldn't talk, and I couldn't eat, and I lost a lot of weight, and finally one night I was like tired of these things in my windpipe, and I was going to rip them out. And this is self-will. I was determined to rip these out, and I was writing to the nurses, I am ripping these out unless you take them out. And I was determined to do that. So they called the doctor, and the doctor said, take them out. So they took them out. I went home, and life went on again. At the age of 18, I moved out of the house. I was February 11th, so I was still in high school, in 12th grade. And the only place to live was a house with five guys in it that was next to a bar. And the guys weren't, none of them, I was not intimate with any of them. They were just my party buddies. I did have a boyfriend, but it was great. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven because the bar would have, you know, bands playing there, and we would drink and party, and then after the bar closed, we'd move over to the house, and we would party till the wee hours of dawn. Somehow I made it through high school. And by the age of 26, I got sober. I'd hit my bottom, and I'd been arrested. I have a felony on my record. I should have had a DUI. I crashed a car. I've been in several car wrecks with cars turned over, and I've walked away from them. And finally, I hit my bottom at the age of 26, and I had been going in and out of treatment centers for 2 years, and there was another substance to which I was addicted, and I didn't think I had an alcohol problem because alcohol hadn't taken me to the depths that methamphetamine had. And so, you know, they kept telling me, oh, you can't drink either, and I was like, yes, I can, yes, I can, yes, I can. And finally, after 2 years of ending up, you know, back at the cop man again, I realized that I'm an alcoholic as well. So I went in treatment and stayed there. I was in treatment for almost 9, 10 months. I was in a halfway house. And after a while, I ended up working in a treatment center. I was a therapist. I did group counseling. I did individual counseling. I did that for 3.5 years. I decided to get my master's degree. So I went to college. I quit working there and went to college, put myself through college, got an associate's degree. When I moved to get a bachelor's degree, I had moved away. I moved away from my sponsor, my friends, my AA meetings, my support system, and what had become most important, my primary purpose now had been to get A's. And so that was my goal. And I graduated 0.01 percentile minus magna cum laude. And, did well, and I was an elementary teacher, did that for several years. And then, finally in 1994, something happened, and I no longer had any AA tools in my toolbox, and the only thing left for me as a solution was to drink. So I did what I did a lot, which was I got a bottle of alcohol in a motel room and would just drink myself into oblivion. And I did that, and, next day, things weren't too bad, So I didn't end up, in the gutter or anything, and I thought I had this thing under control now. I knew a lot about alcoholism. That almost killed me. What I knew about alcoholism. It took me 11 years to get back in the rooms of AA, and during those 11 years, there were a lot of consequences. on January 20th of 2000, I was living in Key West. I had two dogs and a boyfriend, and I had been involved in yoga. I was trying to use yoga to prevent myself from having consequences, because it's a spiritual program, right, yoga? So is AA. It wasn't working real well, but... So this one day, I had there's a restaurant down there that's very fun to work at, and you make good money, and food's good, and the customers are cool, and everybody's happy there. So I wanted a job there, and the owners were two of my yoga students, so they said that they had a job, they had a position available. Somebody was leaving town. So I went out, I quit my job that I had, and I went over there, I put my dog in the basket, and I rode over to the restaurant, and I went to fill out the paperwork, and they said, well, she decided not to leave town, so now I'm unemployed. So poor me, I decided that, I was feeling very sorry for myself, and, what was going to help me was to go stop and get a couple drinks. So I thought I'd stop at the Marquesa in Key West, very nice, classy restaurant, drinking out of stem glasses, isn't as bad as drinking out of a bottle. And so I went and I drank, I had a couple glasses of wine, and then I had a couple more glasses of wine, and then the last thing I remember is drinking the margaritas. And so what happened is the bartender called the cab for me. And the dog was left there. The bike was left there. The dog made it home safely, by the way, that night. And but I didn't. I got home, and the cab dropped me off. And when I was drunk, I used to pull myself up the railings. It was a second-floor apartment. And I was pulling myself up. And when I got to the top railing, at the top of the steps, I missed the railing. And I went back, and I hit my head several steps down, and I laid there at the bottom of the steps for several hours because it was dark and it was late. And when I woke up, I tried to get myself up off the ground, and I couldn't move my arms and I couldn't move my legs. I was paralyzed from the waist down. So I tried to yell for help, and I couldn't move my lips and I couldn't move my tongue. I was completely paralyzed. And so what I did was I laid there and I just opened my mouth and I yelled from the back of my throat a guttural sound as loudly as I could so that hopefully somebody would get my attention. And my neighbor, and I believe that this is a God thing, my neighbor had been sleeping in his house next door and he had a very nice garden and it had been unseasonably warm that January. And he woke up in the middle of the night, and he couldn't get back to sleep, and he remembered that he hadn't watered his plants before he went to bed. So he got out of bed, and he went out, and he watered the plants, and he heard me over there making those guttural sounds on the ground. And I talked to him later after all this. I ended up back home and was able to communicate again, and he said that at first he had ignored me because he thought I was just drunk. And so that's not unusual in Key West to see people lying on the ground making guttural sounds. But so I went to the ambulance picked me up, went to the hospital, and I came out of the coma or being passed out, we're not sure which, and I can remember answering their questions. I knew my name, I knew my social security number, I knew where I lived, and I can even remember thinking, this is good. You know, I'm lucid. And then the next thing I remember is waking up in Miami in Baptist Hospital. And what had happened was I fell into a coma. And I was in a coma for 4.5 days. And when I came out of the coma, the doctor told me that I had a 99.99% chance of dying, which means that I had a 0.01% chance of living. And I realized when I came out of the coma that I couldn't hear anything in my right ear. I'm totally deaf in my right ear from that 100% nerve damage. And I also dislodged the vestibular, which is the balance part of your brain, the hammer, anvil, and stirrup, the smallest bones in your body. So when you walk, you don't think about your balance. But I do. I have to consciously think about my balance. And I lose my balance quite often. And it requires extra energy. I forgot to mention that I had contracted hepatitis C in 1980. My neurologist thinks that I have two autoimmune disorders, and my neurologist thinks that they were caused by the head injury, that there is research that has found that head injuries can cause autoimmune disorders. So I got sober again in 2003. I was in Key West jail. This is after the head injury. I came out of Baptist Hospital in Miami and came back to Key West. The boyfriend was gone because, you know, he thought I was dead. And so the girl that he had been sleeping with while I was away at 11-week yoga training, he had moved in there. So I went through, you know, all this by myself. I wouldn't let my mother come down from Michigan and help me. I didn't have any friends in Key West because we just moved there. So it was a very, very difficult period of time. I moved out to Sedona. I opened a yoga school out there. This is all during my drinking. I never taught my classes drunk, but I did go to classes with many hangovers. But I moved back to West Palm Beach, or I moved to West Palm Beach. Somebody had invited me here to run their yoga school when they'd been to my school in Sedona. So I came here and continued my drinking, and I had gotten arrested in Pennsylvania after the head injury coming down from the Cape, and I had gotten arrested in the Keys after the head injury. So I had two DUIs, a couple more arrests, and then on November 20th of 2003, I was in jail again. And I remember looking at the women in the jail, and they were such losers. Oh, my God. Like, I looked at them, and they were just horrific. And the irony is that I realized at that moment in time that I'm here. I'm with them. I am just like them, if not worse. And that was a spiritual awakening for me. I didn't know it at the time, but it was. And so I got out of jail the next morning, and I called the AA hotline. And they said, well, you have a great clubhouse right around the corner from you, which is the Triangle Club. So I went to the Triangle Club that day, and I started going to 2-3 meetings a day, and I got a sponsor assigned to me. I made a little circle of friends, and one of the girls had a friend who wasn't being very active in the program, and so she needed a sponsee, and I needed a sponsor, and then she hooked us up. Now, I don't think she was really into having a sponsee. We didn't get past the step 2 after a year and a half. Not to blame her. I should have found a new sponsor. But I ended up drinking again on April 30th of 2005. So my new sobriety date is May 1st of 2005. And my sobriety this time, I just celebrated 10 years again, which was quite a monumental task for me because for 21 years I'd been saying, thank you, for 21 years I'd been saying I had 10 years and went out. I had 10 years and went out. I had 10 years and went out. And wouldn't you know, and I have not thought about drinking during those 10 years. I mean, maybe a fleeting thing, but like every cell in my body knew that I was an alcoholic. And then after 10 years, like by May 20th, my little alcoholic brain says, well, you have 10 years now. Maybe it'll be different this time. And I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm thinking that. Like, you know, are you crazy? So I forced the thought away. And then a few days later, it came back. And I thought again, well, isn't that crazy? I know I can't drink. So I'm toying with this thought. And then I was at a meeting, and somebody said something about having God remove. And I realized that I was trying to force that away. I had not asked God to remove that. And so I asked God to remove that thought, and it's been gone since. So I think what I was doing was that I was playing with fire. I love playing with fire. I love adrenaline. I love living on the edge. I can't wait to get on that Ferris wheel. Really, I'm an adrenaline junkie. But, you know, today I am so grateful. I ended up in Mayo Clinic for my back, and they said, well, your back is too unstable to be operated on, but we think you belong over in the liver transplant center. So I went over to the liver transplant center, and I don't like doctors. I don't like going to doctors, but Mayo, I'm telling you, I don't mean to, like, have an advertisement for them, but the doctor was actually waiting for me when I got there, and he said, well, you're a lucky woman. He said, 1 week ago today, the FDA approved of a new drug that, because I couldn't take interferon and ribavirin because of the autoimmune disorders. It's contraindicated. So by the time I got sober in 2005, I was very sick. But I knew that if I just had to keep going to meetings. I had to keep doing service. I had to keep doing what was put in front of me and what I thought was the next right thing. And, you know, some days were really hard. A lot of days I had to stay in bed. But I just, I didn't know how my higher power was going to do it, but I knew that he was eventually going to help me. And so this new drug came out called Harvoni, and I have been free and clear of hepatitis C now since January 28th. Which is a miracle. I'm so grateful. I have, you know, there was a woman down south who has a great circle of friends around her, and I said, you know, I would love that circle of friends that she says have around you. And she said, well, you have to create it then. And I do. I have them today. I have a wonderful husband. I have my best friend who, you know, I'm wearing a tiara because of her. She celebrates every single little thing in life, and she's teaching me how to do that. And I have sponsees who I just adore. They're just wonderful. They're just great, great women, and I'm so thankful for everything that my higher power has brought to me. And, you know, I'm talking, and, you know, as far as being deaf, it really does affect me. People do not understand how being deaf affects you. You know, I notice walls and, you know, the acoustics and where the sound waves are going to get caught from wherever I sit. And if there are drapes or cushions, because the sound waves get trapped in them. But there are some benefits I've learned from being deaf. You can get on airplanes first. Okay. That's great. Also, when you fill out applications to sign up for things like conventions, you check deaf. You'll get to sit up front. I mean, it's, you know, you do learn to read lips and facial expressions and body language. Like, we're adaptable creatures for survival. But it does help to be able to sit up front, to be able to see these things. And I think I'm running out of time, but you know, in talking, hearing what I heard here today, I said to my husband this morning, I made a comment. I said, you know, where can I learn sign language? And after hearing what I heard today, I think that I might have some work to do in the deaf community, because I can hear. And there's a guy at home that says, you know, gratitude can come out your eyes and your nose. And that's what's happening. So I wish I didn't cry. I always cry when I share in front of big groups. But I'm very grateful to be here. I love AA. I love AA more than life. And everything I have in my life is because of AA. Thanks.